open our Rules Committee. I thank everybody for being here. And we're going to, first, while we're waiting for one of our other members to get here, we're going to open a public hearing on HJM 23, because we have a representative here. So we're going to open a public hearing on HJM 23. Representative Riley, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HJM 23 urges the United States Senate to pass binding legislation ratifying the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. The Convention on the Rights of the Child is an international document based on four core principles: non-discrimination, the best interest of the child's right to survival, development and protection from harm, abuse, and exploitation, and respect for the views of the child. It emphasizes attention to particularly vulnerable children, such as victims of conflict, challenged children, refugee children, and children of minorities. Describes standards in health care, education, and in legal, civil, and social services that are intended to serve as guidelines for the development of policies and programs to protect the well-being of children. The United Nations General Assembly unanimously adopted the Convention on the Rights of the Child nearly 20 years ago in November of 1989. It has since been ratified by 193 nations. The United States signed the convention in 1995, but it and Somalia are apparently the only remaining members of the UN that have not ratified it.
And with that explanation, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Chuck Riley, representing the heart of Washington County. Now that Jerry's given my testimony, just a couple of things. He mentioned that this was ratified during Reagan administration, and the provisions regarding a child's right to freedom of thought, speech, association, religion, and privacy were largely inserted by U.S. delegates at the request of President Reagan's administration. In 1995, it was signed by Madeleine Albright. However, it's never been forwarded to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for consideration. That has to be done by the President. And as he pointed out, one of the things I was going to say is, we're in good company having not signed this. We and Somalia are the two who have not signed it of the members of the United Nations. Let me quote you just a few things out of this document. And I didn't bring formal testimony, but I want to read just half a dozen quotes. State parties shall respect the responsibilities, rights, duties of parents. Recognize every child has the inherent right to life. State parties shall ensure that a child should not be separated from his or her parents against their will, except when competent authorities, subject to judicial review, determine in accordance with applicable law and procedures that such separation is necessary for the best interest of the child. State parties shall take measures to combat illicit transfer and non-return of children abroad. Regarding religion, state parties shall respect the rights and duties of parents and, when applicable, legal guardians to provide direction to the child. State parties shall take appropriate measures, including legislative, administrative, social, and educational measures, to protect children from illicit use of narcotic drugs and psychotropic substances. State parties will undertake to protect a child from all forms of sexual exploitation and sexual abuse. This is a good bill. This is something that we should have done a long time ago. And with that, I'm glad to answer any questions. And if you choose to, you and the committee choose to pass along, I'd love to carry it.
Okay. Any questions of Representative Bradley? Seeing none, thank you very much. We're going to come back to this one later, so we're going to leave this hearing open. So I know there are a couple other people who are here to speak to it. We'll do that shortly. Our first order of business, but I have two more representatives that are also busy. Would you like to get your testimony and then... Okay, so we will open public hearings on Senate Bill 507A and 508A as well. No, we'll just take testimony right now. We'll talk about that later so that you guys can get on. And yes?
You Don't need a written identification.
Don't even have to do that.
Okay, very good. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm going to be uncharacteristically brief and to the point. We need these two bills because they settle disadvantages for physicians doing business in Oregon. We have a number of problems in our health care system that make it disadvantageous for a physician to move to Oregon or attempt to move to Oregon to do business. The first of those we've dealt with in a different bill, which has to do with state licensing and streamlining that and getting it done in a proper amount of time beyond this. Once a physician is licensed in Oregon, then they have to get credentialed by the various health plans from which cover the patients that they're going to be seeing. And that takes an inordinately long period of time for God knows what reason, but it does. So this 507 simply says that once a physician is licensed in Oregon and set up to do practice, they may bring in patients, and the health plans will pay for those patients under the expectation that they'll be credentialed over time. And I really think we can shorten that time up, too, but, you know, that's a whole other issue.
Be sure and identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. State Representative Jim Thompson, House District 23, West Valley. Sorry about that.
No problem.
I'm used to being on that
side. I do that. Yeah.
508 is another little perturbation, and that has to do with overpayment and clawback. And it's throughout the health system, but particularly difficult for physicians in private practice. When they submit their billing claims to an insurance company, and then those claims are paid, they assume that the account is closed. But the way it's set up, those things can be audited, and an insurance company come back 2 years later and say, oh, we think we overbilled you or overpaid you back in 2007, and we'd like $7,423 paid back. This bill simply says we're putting a time limit on that. You either catch the mistakes if they are there in a relatively short amount of time and get the business done, or you lost it. And it's throughout the whole health system. They're doing it to pharmacies, they're doing it to hospitals, everybody, and we need to tighten that up for good business reasons. And the reason we need these is because we're having a hard time attracting doctors to Oregon because these are the kinds of things that doctors know about nationally. Right now, the premier state to go to is Texas. They've solved a lot of their tort problems. Their pay is good. They've ironed out a lot of these nonsense problems, and you can actually practice medicine in Texas, and they're importing doctors by the boatload. We're having a very hard time in Oregon, particularly in rural areas, because of these kinds of issues. I'd really like to see you give these bills a shot and get them into a work session. The problems will not go away.
Any questions for our representative? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 284B. And we'll hear a short explanation of the bill, which we've had before us before.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 284B increases the statute of ultimate repose for product liability actions, including wrongful death, to 10 years, or the statute of ultimate repose of the state in which the product was manufactured or from which it was imported, whichever is later. It exempts manufactured home. It applies to causes of action arising after the effective date. It exempts physicians unless involved in the manufacture or design of the product. It exempts product liability actions for damages from halide or mercury vapor light bulb from being subject to any statute of repose, and it applies retroactively to halide or mercury vapor light bulbs product liability suits. You have previously discussed examples of injuries related to particular products, similar laws in other states, the scope of product liabilities, actions, and some amendment language.
And we have two amendments that we've accepted, the dash ones and the dash twos, is that correct?
Dash 17
and 18. 17 and 18, that's right. It came to us later.
Yep.
That have both been adopted for the here. Have both been introduced.
They've been introduced, not adopted.
Correct.
Would you like a description of those?
Sure.
Okay. The -B17 amendment adds hospitals to the declaration of Section 9 that physicians are not manufacturers, distributors, sellers, or lessors of products for the purposes of ORS 30.900 to 30.920. The -18 amendment replaces the original measure. It incorporates the -17 amendment. Specifies that the time limitation against product liability actions in ORS 30.905 does not apply to actions brought against manufacturers, distributors, sellers, or lessors of manufactured dwellings or manufactured or prefabricated structures.
And the
-18s? That's the -18s.
And does it have the... does it take away the...
use of the other provisions in other states?
The other states' provision.
I think so.
Yes, I believe it does.
I believe it does.
It's my understanding that it does, but I'll have to double check.
I believe that it does as well.
I believe that it does.
Did you want to ask me to invite someone up?
Yes, I think I would like to hear about the main bill and what it means for hospitals specifically.
So... if Kristen Leonard would come forward, we would appreciate it.
I will
allow Representative Berger for a question.
Yeah, thank you. the -17s specifically exclude hospitals from the language, the doctors are. There has been some discussion as to whether the hospitals are specifically included or not in the original bill without the -17 amendments, or where they would stand vis-a-vis product liabilities, because hospitals don't produce a product.
Exactly.
They don't manufacture anything.
For the record,
except maybe healthcare, we hope.
For the record, Kristen Leonard on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I do want to add the caveat that I do not practice law. I particularly do not practice products liability law, so I called someone a little bit earlier to hopefully get you an answer to the question you have, and I can get further information if it's necessary as well. So if I'm understanding the question correctly, it's does the bill in its B engrossed form specifically add in hospitals as potential manufacturers and sellers? Or maybe you're asking it the other way around, but let me answer here as to what, when the language was codified as it relates to medical providers, so doctors, not being a manufacturer or seller. So as an example, if you're putting in a heart valve, does that, just by virtue of the fact that you're implanting that, does that make you a manufacturer or seller? All along, our folks have believed that that by using a product, that does not make you the manufacturer or seller of the product. Our understanding of is that that would be the same case for hospitals. As far as if you're not manufacturing or, you know, serving as the distributor of the product, then you, this would not apply to you. If so, that would be how I would characterize it as to whether or not there are situations where institutions could be a seller. That I think would be a definition hospital by hospital. But as
Ms. Leonard, thank you. Here is my problem. I have a new hip. Mm-hmm. Okay. And should it go wrong, I couldn't sue the doctor who put it in. The question is, could I sue the hospital that sold it to the doctor? Because that would be the seller of the product, because that's who I really purchased this new hip from. And so there's the nexus, if you will.
But I think, Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, I think... We are talking here in this bill about a dangerously defective product as manufactured, and so I think if there is something that is defective in the form of the form with which it was manufactured, then that is something that's got to be fleshed out, for lack of a better description, by the plaintiff as they're trying to figure out who is responsible for your hip. So is it something in the way that the hip was implanted, or is there some manufacturer defect in the hip that was implanted in your body? So I would characterize right now there are a couple exceptions on the books in Oregon as it relates to dangerously defective medical products, and they are breast implants and IUDs because in the form with which they were manufactured, they were defective. It was not the doctor or the hospital or any entity implanting those devices. It was the form in which the device was manufactured.
Well, I guess my concern is this. There is no intention in the original bill that because the hospital sold my hip to me, separate from the physician who is named as exempt in here.
Mm-hmm.
But the physician didn't sell it, the hospital did. And that therein lies the difficulty. They are the seller of the product. And so I guess I'm reading they wouldn't be out of this bill.
I think in some circumstances that's exactly right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Anybody else have any questions or...
Good question, Mr. Chair. So for...
Hello?
Sure. Or for the general public.
We aren't in a public hearing, though.
Okay, thank you. So then, currently, are hospitals defendants in suits under the current? I mean, just as the bill stands now...
8 years.
8 years. Are they or are they not currently defendants in these type of product liability suits because they're the sellers of products?
And Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, I would prefer actually if someone's here from the Hospital Association and they can get up and testify whether or not they've been called in on any of these suits, because I'm not aware of any, but that's not to say that they may not.
We will invite you up. Just identify yourself for the record.
Yep. Thank you. For the record, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Chair Roblin, thank you for the opportunity to answer as many questions as I can. Representative Edwards, I think hospitals typically are not the primary focus of a products liability case because, as has been pointed out, we are primarily the providers of health care. While I cannot cite you specific examples, it's very typical for hospitals to be named in any lawsuit involving perhaps a hip, just as one of the many entities that were involved in the implantation of the hip. It might have been a bad product, but then so the manufacturer might be named, and then the hospital is also named. Everybody that touched the patient is named in these lawsuits. And our concern with the bill as drafted, while we don't think that hospitals are the primary focus of this bill, but neither are physicians. And when physicians are expressly excluded, then other healthcare providers, such as hospitals, the implication is that we are manufacturers, distributors, sellers of products and could be sued under this theory. So we just want it clarified that if physicians are not, then hospitals are acting in much the same manner, also are not. We also have difficulties with the public policy behind this entire bill, and I'm happy to address those as you like. But in more specific answer to your question, our main reason for the -17s is to remove that implication that hospitals remain a focus of a products liabilities case, and I don't really think that is anybody's intent.
And Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, what I can do is I can kind of put a query out to our folks and get a sense from the couple folks who actually practice this type of law if there are instances of the hospitals being named and what that looks like. Because I'm sorry to say, I just don't actually know.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was that you put a provision in here specifically exempting hospitals from the product liability.
Doctors.
I thought she was representing the American the Hospital Association.
There's an amendment, the dash 17.
Right.
Yes. That is limited. Yes.
That excludes the hospitals?
Chair Roblin, Representative Jensen, yes, it does, in the same way that physicians are excluded.
My question on this, the hospital is selling, in my case, an E. The physician isn't selling an E, but the hospital is, and believe me, they made a healthy profit on it. They are the sellers of a product.
Chair Roman, Representative Jensen, it sounds like the wisest thing for me to do would be to follow up, because we are we deal with durable medical equipment, and some hospitals have durable medical equipment relationships or companies, and if you want me to follow up on that, I definitely will. Typically, better said, it may vary depending on which hospital and whether the hospital sold the product or whether we own the durable medical equipment or whether we buy it from somebody else. I can certainly clarify that for the committee if you'd like.
Okay. I want to know who to sue 20 years from
now. I know. If he wants to sue 20 years from now, isn't he?
Well, I know. I'm just thinking that I'd be happy to thank you for the opportunity to answer these questions, and I'll follow up on that, Representative Jensen. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, Representative Edwards, I would accept a motion.
Mr. Chair, having listened to the testimony, I'm prepared to move Senate Bill 284B, as it sits right now, to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves House Senate Bill 284B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Burke.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't be supporting the motion because I do have this issue with the hospitals being not specifically named, and also the product liability going back to the other states issue leaves me pause, so I can't support it without amendment. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard.
No.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Nope.
Vice Chair Edwards.
Aye.
Chair Roblin.
Aye. Motion passes.
Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I hope that when I'm sitting in this chamber waiting to file a suit against somebody 20 years from now on my knee, that this issue of ultimate repose is not one that keeps coming back to haunt me.
Representative Berger.
Yes, I'd like to notice of a possible minority report on this bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We need to figure out a carrier for this bill. Anybody up here would love to carry this bill? If not, I would be glad to. What are you thinking?
No.
And if it changes, I'll let somebody know. Okay. I will carry, unless I'll get back to you if we change that between now and then, but I think we're okay. So we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 284B.
Representative,
have we decided? Are we carrying that over, Representative Gelser?
I think we're carrying it over. Are we carrying it over?
I'm feeling comfortable with that. Okay with carrying 2749 over? We had an amendment drafted. It turned out to be unconstitutional. We're still working it.
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to carry to Senate Bill, House Bill 2749 over to Wednesday, because we had an amendment drafted, which turned out to be not work the way we'd wanted it to. And so we are holding that over till Wednesday. And hopefully we'll have a different amendment then. Let's go to open a public hearing on House Bill 2989. And we'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 2989 allows the Department of Human Services to contract directly with mental health and developmental disabilities providers if it determines that the program offered by a county is not satisfactory. You have before you a Dash 1 amendment which replaces the original measure. It requires the Department of Human Services to conduct rulemaking to establish a certification program for persons who inspect cross connections, test backflow assemblies, and who service, maintain, and perform inline repairs on backflow assemblies. It prohibits such certification from including the installation or removal of a backflow assembly. Currently under ORS 430.640, if there is an emergency situation in no community... forget that. That's the background on the other bill.
Okay. Don't need that one. Okay. So given that, we're going to invite... is it Jason Hauser? Jill... Wagon, I guess? You'll have to pronounce it, Smith. And Michael Burmeister. I messed up all those names, so we'll let you guys do it correctly.
Not too bad, actually.
Oh, that's true.
Because I think there may be some people here on the original bill.
There may be some people here on the original bill, which is House Bill 2989, the original bill. This is a bill that we're looking at the amendment only as opposed to the regular bill. So just if anybody's out there and is wondering. Those have asked, I've told that to before, but with that,
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Jason Huser, Legislative Affairs Manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board, again joined by my colleagues Jill Hoenga and Michael Briesemeister. And yes, to reiterate for the record, this is what would be called a gut and stuff bill. I'm very thankful to the original sponsor of the underlying bill, Representative Kotek, for giving us permission to bring forward these Dash 1 amendments and bring this language before you today for your consideration. Backflow device. As the name suggests, keep water going the right way. They are an important part of the safety net to protect drinking water and the public health. I think there is, I guess you could describe it, a complication in state law that makes it very rare that individuals have the skill set to both and authority to both test and repair these devices. This is an obstacle in ensuring that these devices, when they've been tested and been found to be in failure, it's a delay in seeing that they're repaired as soon as possible. When you consider the stakes as far as drinking water and public health, we think that a day or even a week's delay, a week or even a day's delay is unacceptable. And this language will go a long ways in ensuring that these devices are repaired in the most timely way possible. The Dash 1 amendments allow certified testers to service and maintain backflow devices, including inline repairs. And from there, I'd like to turn it over to my colleagues to show you a little bit more about a backflow device. We have a prop here in front of you. Please don't be alarmed. It's not a weapon. And Michael and Jill will take it from here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Hoyenga. I'm the Water Management Services Supervisor at Eugene Water and Electric Board. And I'm deaf, so maybe I try to compensate by speaking a little bit lower. I'm a state-certified backflow assembly tester since 91. I'm also a certified cross-connection specialist, and I'm also a certified instructor for both of those disciplines. Mike Briesemeister, part of my staff, is also a tester and a specialist and an instructor for both of those disciplines, and he's going to be doing the demonstration of what an inline repair means, and so I'll let him take it away. I'd like this to be on the record, so that's why he is doing this demonstration. Thank you. This is a double check valve. He's removing, he's entering the check, one of the two checks in this assembly. And there's the spring, and then there's what's called a poppet that has a seal and that seal sometimes need to be replaced. That's one of the possible inline repairs. One of the more common inline repairs is simply removing debris, either by flushing or by just picking it out and then making sure everything's cleaned up, and then replacing all the working parts and making sure that the, and then testing after the repair to make sure it's in proper working order. Thank you for that. Clear authority for state certified testers to perform inline repairs is specified in this amendment, and it's critical to water purveyors for being able to maintain water quality throughout the distribution system from source to tap. If the backflow assembly installation has been required, that means there's a known hazard, and that if it's not malfunctioning, it needs to be placed back into proper operation as soon as possible. When the backflow assembly testing program was developed in Oregon in the mid-60s and throughout the 70s and 80s into 1992, backflow assembly testers were trained to perform repairs, inline repairs, and their certification authorized them to do so. And I became a tester during that time, and I remember our recertification courses, as well as our certification courses, included what we called a repair circuit, where we went around and did 4 to 6 repairs on new or other assemblies in order to assure that we had that expertise. Since the mid-1990s, licensed plumbers are the only professionals authorized to perform repair on any and all backflow assemblies. There, it, over time, has been a few other licensees that are able to do very limited instances of repairs. This is in spite of the fact that in Oregon, the state-certified backflow testers get identical training to the licensed plumbers. Also, I'd like to point out that since 1993, at this time, as of April or so, there's approximately 14% of the certified testers are licensed plumbers. That means that there's a not many people available to actually do the work, this really critical work. And in 12 of 30 counties in Oregon, there are no licensed plumbers that available to do this work according to the state list that's available online from DHS. Again, I want to reiterate that whenever there's a backflow assembly, there's a hazard to public health. Those hazards include such things as battery and paint manufacturing. Don't want to be drinking that. Hospitals and dental, other medical facilities, boilers, mechanical systems, and even irrigation systems found in homes that are subject to stormwater intrusion. So they're everywhere, and they're protecting you 24/7. And they're required to be tested annually to make sure they're in working order, since a mechanical device and it can fail. And after this rigorous 24/7 due diligence of all the work that water purveyors do to keep the water pure from source to tap, it's really difficult for us to come to a place where there's a failed assembly and there's a delay, or maybe in the case of places where there's not even a licensed plumber in the county, quite a delay in getting a repair. My written testimony includes tabulation of the available testers and plumbers county by county. That also includes the OAR information from about their training requirements, both for certified testers and for licensed plumbers. And I wanted to just point out that EWEB's goal in supporting this amendment is to assure same-day repairs when possible. This provides the maximum protection for public health. And there's a lot more text. I skipped some highlights, but my testimony in its entirety only takes one page, and I encourage you all to take a read, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gerard.
This is not meant to be detrimental to plumbers. I want to make sure. If the test and the repair look pretty simple, why are so many counties without plumbers that can do that. Is this just that the plumbers fail to go get certified? It can't be because it's that complex.
I'm not able to speak to the plumbing community. I'm a water purveyor. So if there's someone in the room that could answer that question.
Yes, that's my answer.
We have some plumbers coming. Other questions? I guess, yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, I have a question. Is statute clear that you have to have a plumber? Could a homeowner repair it themselves?
There are some stipulations. Let's see. People other than licensed plumbers that can repair, landscape contractors with, if they have the proper licensing, can do repairs, but only on landscape assemblies. And so what that means is that when they go to commercial facilities, there's several assemblies they're allowed to test, and one of those assemblies is an irrigation assembly. If the irrigation assembly is in proper working order and one of the other assemblies is not in proper working order, they are not allowed to repair the other assembly because it's not part of the irrigation system. Homeowners can, with no training or certification, are allowed to repair or replace their own assemblies. Employees can repair assemblies on their employer properties, and anyone can repair or replace assemblies that are protecting standalone fire systems and irrigation systems. Those are directly served by a meter. They are not attached to any domestic plumbing, and that's because those two types of systems are not in the jurisdiction of the plumbing code.
Thank you.
What was the answer?
Yes.
Homeowners can, yes.
I got lost.
Other questions? I guess my biggest question was if the other thing that can go wrong with those sometimes is they have an internal crack, and so they'll have a leak in that device, and that would also be an inline repair, taking it out and putting it in, right?
That would not be included as an inline repair.
So what's the definition of inline repair?
An inline repair is something that replaces the internal parts.
Okay.
Or removes debris from the internals,
but
does not include cutting any pipe, does not include any installation or removal. The inline repair falls under the same jurisdiction as the exempt from ordinary minor plumbing repairs from permit requirements, and so that it's under that definition. But if any pipe is cut into, that's not included as a repair in this language.
Strictly accessing it through the caps here.
And since you spoke, we get to have you identify yourself.
Mike Briesmeister, also with Eugene Water and Electric Board.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for this panel?
Really quickly.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To clarify, inline repairs, is that defined in elsewhere in statute or in the bill? I don't see that necessarily defined.
Mr. Chair.
I see.
In the language, it says specifically.
Including but not limited to.
Internal components, special assembly 2, and then if you go to the language, there is language that says it does not include, and I'm not remembering where exactly that language is. Yeah, number, is B2, a certification issued under this section does not authorize the holder to install or remove a backflow assembly. So that's specifically spelled out in this language.
Okay.
I guess it's line 17 and 18.
Yeah, I see that now. Thank you.
Certainly.
Can I try again, Representative Greer?
I've been sitting here thinking on how I... Yes, if I could.
Please.
In anyone's opinion, why don't we see more plumbers capable of doing this? Or licensed to do it, not capable.
I, again, respectfully must say that I cannot speak for the plumbing community. I'm a water purveyor, and I don't want to even pretend to speak for them. Thank you, sir.
Chair Roblin, Representative Gard, we don't see any obstacles to the plumbers being able to do that, but as far as why people don't, I don't think we can answer that specifically.
Yeah. And since 1993, there's been sufficient time.
But the question I think he's getting at is there were a number of counties you said that don't have any?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they're either not putting in backflow devices or They're all irrigation ones, which other people are capable of fixing, because somebody has to take care of those in those counties.
Chair, respectfully, I believe almost every county has at least one medical facility, and the plumbing code and the state requires backflow assemblies in medical facilities,
right.
And maybe that's not the case, but I would hope so.
I would, too, having been on a water board myself.
Just a comment. I know we bought a fairly new house in Klamath, and for the first time in my life, we had a backflow device that had to be checked, and it cost about $25, and then the certifier notified the city of Klamath Falls that it was operating, and that was it. And they come back every year and do the same thing. So, but I'm still curious as to why plumbers don't do it. So. But I'll have to ask my local plumbers.
Okay. We'll have some people coming up shortly.
Oh, a plumber?
No further questions. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Christina McMitt. And is it Katie Mattenrow?
Thank you.
Or is it Matthew? I don't know.
Is that a good business?
Madam
Moore? Part in the window? I mean, it's wide open.
Have fun with that.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Backflow Testers Association, and we're in support of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2989, which, as you've heard, would allow Oregon state-certified backflow assembly testers to service and make, quote-unquote, inline repairs to backflow assemblies. And these are, as you just discussed, strictly limited to accessing the internal components of a backflow prevention assembly to facilitate flushing and cleaning and to replace the parts to return them to manufacturer's specifications. The bill would clearly not allow a tester to do what we think of as more typically plumbing work, which is cutting and fitting pipes, replacing the assembly. So in the example that Chair Roblin brought up, if there was a cracked housing, that would clearly be in a plumber's purview. Testers currently are trained and certified through the Department of Human Services, which has delegated authority to implement the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. And although certified testers receive training on performing repairs, and they have since the 70s, current statute is silent about whether or not a certified tester may actually perform a repair. So House Bill 2989, as amended, would allow for same-day repairs of failed assemblies by the certified testers. Where our goal really is to increase the number of qualified service providers to be able to service the growing number of backflow assemblies that are located across the state in every county, whether or not there are certified plumbers who can also test their own repairs. I'd like to introduce Kate Mattimore. She's with BMI Backflow, and Kate is my certified smart person from my organization who can answer questions about testing and all of the various related rules to that. And I think Representative Garrard, she might even hazard an answer to your question.
Look forward to that. Okay, I don't know where to begin. If I should just answer your question, I think I could do that. Kate Mattimore, and I'm the co-owner of a company called Backflow Management Incorporated. We train testers. We don't necessarily test. So.
Mr. Chair, shall I reiterate?
Representative Garrard, why don't you ask a question?
Kate, why are there not more plumbers who are certified to do this testing?
Okay. Representative Roblin to Representative Garrard. I think the main reason is the apprenticeship programs that the plumbers go through. That's not part of their training. That's not part of their curriculum. And I speak on that because I served for 7 years on the State Bureau of Labor Apprenticeship Board. And that never has been part of their training. They offer it as a sideline training. So it's not something that they really go for. And it's also the small things. It's not like a project, like a big job. And, you know, would they drive, you know, 500 miles to test one assembly in a county that their argument, you know, that there's not a plumber in? Would they, you know, do they go for, like, your irrigation system? Would they drive to Cave Falls if there was not a plumber in your county? That's where the problem is. There's testers all over in each county who would be able to do repairs, to do the simple repairs, but the fact is that it just doesn't pencil out for a plumber, and it doesn't pencil out for the consumer who has to pay a trip charge and that type of thing. So that's really, I mean, it's both. It's, you know, it's, I think it's driven by the consumers and by the plumber's need for that trip charge plus the hourly rate. You got yours tested for $25, right?
It's a good bill. It saves two bills from coming to you.
So how is it getting done in those counties where there aren't certified plumbers now?
It's either going lengthy times without repair until they can get a plumber there to, like, do a bunch of them, to do a bunch of repairs, or people are probably just, you know, the irrigation people, if they're, you know, if they can do it, they probably would. You know, it kind of comes down to, there's a lot of ones that I know my company manages a lot of different water systems, and so I see the test reports coming in, and there's sometimes where it's a year before it's actually repaired.
So in other words, what happens when it's not repaired? Is it, do they have to turn the system off, or is it just at risk of backflow?
No, it's at risk of backflow. There's, like, the double check that he showed you, double meaning there's two checks in there. If one of them fails, it's possible that the other one would prevent backflow. But that's not always a given, in particular with debris, because debris usually rolls through and damages both checks. So,
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I have one of these things in my yard, and I've been fascinated with this discussion because if it goes bad, I don't want to have to call a plumber, but I have a son-in-law who I know could do what that guy just did. So I like this bill, because if the homeowner can do it, then the homeowner can get her son-in-law to do it.
Homeowner can do it now.
That's about what I mean. That's what I mean. I think, I mean, I could probably do what he did there if it was standing in front of me, but if it involved digging in the dirt, I'd be less likely. But as far as the repair itself, it looks pretty straightforward, this inline repair.
Thank you.
It is.
Representative Jensen.
I certainly appreciate Representative Berger's comments on this. I certainly appreciate that that I don't think I'd have much trouble doing this, even if it meant digging in the dirt. But I'm still not satisfied with the responses to Representative Garg's question. It seems to me the basic reason for these backflow is public health.
That's true.
To prevent things from getting into the water system that are undesirable and that represent health problems.
All right.
This is an exercise that any fifth grader could do with any mechanical aptitude at all. Certainly any plumber could do it with any mechanical. I mean, they already have that. It's a given, certainly. I do agree it's $25 is much cheaper than calling a plumber up. However, if the plumber, I cannot see if a individual can be qualified to do it under the guise of public health, that a plumber wouldn't be automatically qualified to do it. It that makes no sense to me. Except that creates another market. That's wonderful.
And Representative Nolan.
I am in awe of my colleagues' plumbing expertise. I'm not particularly interested in digging in the dirt or even working on a clean pipe. I am interested in understanding whether there are boundaries within either the bill. Well, it's the proposed amendment, because the amendment replaces the bill. To make sure that any changes we're making are indeed, in terms of authorizing others to do this work, are de minimis. Because I'm a firm believer in high quality well-skilled work being done, not just on my own house, but on the houses in my neighborhood, because if some of my neighbors do inadequate work in plumbing or other home improvements, it has the potential to damage my property as well. I'm interested in knowing whether the proposed amendment has some limits on what is authorized to be done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I'd be happy to address that. Our goal on behalf of the Backflow Testers Association really is not with respect to the plumbers at all. We welcome them into the business. I think our struggle is that we recognize as service providers that there are not enough qualified service providers to be able to address the number of failed assemblies. In EWEB's territory alone, they have 13,000 assemblies that need to be tested on an annual basis, and only a handful of plumbers who are also certified to test their own repair. They can make the repair, but then the homeowner may need to call out another tester. So our goal is to carve out the simple repair, and that's why we've termed it the inline repair, which really is as simple as what you just saw. It's not traditional plumbing service providing. It's not cutting pipe, welding pipe, fitting pipe, replacing an assembly. It simply is unscrewing that check valve. Once you unscrew that check valve, that's considered a repair. And most of the time, like 90% of the time, it just requires flushing. Like there may be gravel or dirt in there, and it's unseated the seal. So you flush that with water, and you re-screw it on. And then, of course, the tester retests that repair on site, and you do that by testing the pressure valve, gauge, pressure, yes. Something. It has to read within a certain parameter, and that's what the testers are also schooled and certified to do. And then they leave knowing that any failed backflow assembly is now functioning properly and the risk to public health has been resolved. The bill...
Can I follow up?
Oh, yes.
Thank you for that explanation, Ms. McNitt. How much time do you anticipate that one of these simple inline fixes might at most take one of these inspectors to do? Is it something that gets done in 5 minutes, or is it something that will take 5 hours?
Less than 5 minutes. Less than 5 minutes to open that up and flush it. You know, if you had to replace a component, it might take you another 5 minutes to go to your truck and get that. It's like a washer at your sink, something like the disc to replace it.
May I follow up again?
Absolutely.
What's the danger that in opening this up, the inspector might create a problem that needs emergency repair by a more sophisticated technician like a plumber?
Chair Roblin to Representative Nolan. There's shutoff valves in various places along the water system. The double check that he had shutoff valves on both ends of it, so it could be shut off, you know, at that point. There's also usually, like, say, on an irrigation system, there's a secondary shutoff further upstream towards the water system, and then ultimately there's always a shutoff at the meter, too, in case anything went horribly wrong, but I can't imagine. Yeah, usually these are, it's a very simple thing. There's not, you know, if anything, you would improve it, not further damage it by opening it.
Mr. Chair, with that explanation, and if you are going to have other people to testify, I will query them along the same lines. If, in fact, there is consistent understanding that that is the effect of these amendments, that we're talking about a five-minute effort to basically cleanse the mechanism of grit and other things, that makes some sense to me, to allow inspectors to be able to do that. If we're talking about anything more complicated than that, I'm nervous about the potential damage to that property owner's facilities, but and they take that risk on themselves. But in particular, I'm concerned about the potential impact on adjacent property owners by someone ill-equipped to do the repairs, trying to do them.
Right. Chair, to Representative Nolan, just to clarify, the testers are actually trained and certified to do the work that they do. They go through training, and then every 2 years they go through update training as well. So they're very skilled in looking, you know, at the potential problems and recognizing, you know, the trends of what, you know, and what to do with it. So it's not like they're not an untrained individual going out there. A lot of them even work for the water systems, you know, doing it on huge, huge pipes, you know, like up to 12-inch type assemblies that would need a crane to be installed. So it's there's really a lot of skill that these backflow assembly testers have. In addition, if they are out testing for the public, they are required to have bond and insurance. They have to be either licensed through the Construction Contractors Board or the Landscape Contractors Board. So there's a lot of insurances there that say if something, you know, they would be covered because they can't go out and test for a fee unless they're covered by those.
Okay, one last question.
Absolutely.
Can we anticipate that next session you'll be back with another bill that moves this goalpost just a little bit further and maybe then just a little bit further the next time? Good. And that didn't make it onto the tape,
Mr. Let's Chair.
Mr.
Chair.
Note that their heads
Nolan,
were shaking.
So that
no.
I can state this on the record, so everyone in the public can hear rather than watch body language. No, we absolutely do not anticipate coming back and expanding this authority. This would be a resolution of a long developing issue, and I think that it would be good for service providers, both the plumbers and the testers, and for Oregonians.
Great. Thank you for your indulgence,
and
Mr. Chair.
When I have one question. When you test, you obviously have to open up the system and put some equipment on the line to figure out the pressure.
Yes.
So you're already doing some of the same things, right?
There's test ports on there that you actually, they're just kind of smaller little test ports. There's four of them on each assembly. And so that's where you hook your gauges up to. So in other words, you're going to be hooking up your gauge like on each side of this check, and then that's how you tell the pressure difference. And then when you do the second check, you move your gauge to these two. You open up the water by turning those screws there that open up the water on it. They also act to flush. Sometimes a tester will really flush the heck out of these test ports to see if they can't clear a problem, you know, without even opening it. Sometimes that will work. Not always. Sometimes you just have to get inside.
So once you find that there is a problem as a tester, you let them know that there's a problem, but you don't do anything until they get somebody to fix it. So
a lot of times they just, I'm sorry, Chair Nolan. A lot of times what they have to do is they would have to walk away from it. Essentially, they would, you know, just take off their test gear, you know, turn the water back on, notify the customer, whether it was a mortuary or somebody's irrigation system, it makes no difference. They would have to walk away from it and not be able to repair it. So, you know, then it's up to the customer to figure out what to do. And then that's the ultimate problem that we keep seeing, you know, on our side of it, is they turn it back to the customer. The customer will call a plumber. Eventually, the plumber will come out and do the repair, but the plumber maybe is a tester, maybe isn't. So then they have to call back that tester again to come back and retest it to make sure that it passed. And so it's an awful thing for the consumers in Oregon to have to go through this.
So I guess the next question I have has to do with testing. You find there's a problem as a tester, and we have this bill is passed, and you get to fix it. So then do you send the bill for the fix as well as the bill for the testing?
I think most testers, if all they had to do was flush it and it didn't involve any parts, that, you know, it would be like a minimal, you know, like they might charge an extra $5 or something because they had to disassemble it. A lot of times, at least the testers that I know of, they just do it. You know, it's a matter of, you know, case. If they have to do parts, usually, you know, they would have to charge for the parts and the time.
Because the only problem I have with that is that we see on TV, there for a while on a nightly basis, the mechanics in the little service stations that test the car and say it has this problem, and they've already worked it out that it really didn't have any problems because they've teched into it. And so you get this group of people who go out and test it. Lo and behold, every time they test, there's a little bit of a problem, and they fix that little problem, and they send you another bill for that part.
Yeah.
So that...
Well, I'm sure that goes on in just about every industry. It's like the bad side of it. I would hope that the people that go through my training classes are those type of people.
Okay, I agree.
But, you know,
thank you,
Chair, for allowing me to speak to that. As a water purveyor that's been working in cross connection.
You should probably identify yourself.
My name is Jill Hoyenga from the Eugene Water and Electric Board. As a water purveyor that's been involved with the cross connection program for over 13 years, we keep an eye on our local testers and begin to question if there's repair could be true, that's what's needed, but we will often go have a conversation with the tester and with the customer to find out what the deal is. I also wanted to speak to Representative Nolan's question. And if you look in the attachments, you will see the requirements for the certification for the testers, and you will see that the licensed plumber OARs refer to the DHS certification requirements, so they receive the same training.
Thank you. That helps.
And this is kind of an interesting one because it's really a couple different boards. We've got DHS involved mm-hmm. in this, but we also have over here in Boley and a whole bunch of other
right.
groups. So this makes it a slightly unique situation. Representative Garrard.
Just a simple comment. This is amazing how this legislative body can take a simple, good consumer bill and make it so complex that we're now all in doubt.
I wanted to add one thing. The water purveyor will sometimes, and especially if there's a true hazard, if it needs to be repaired, we require it to be shut off until repaired.
Okay, that makes me feel more comfortable.
That's a clarification.
Didn't come through.
I do appreciate that. So when a tester does the testing, the information goes back to the water purveyor from
yes.
which the testing was done.
By the Department of Human Services. By the Department of Human Services, they're required within 10 days to submit that report to the water purveyor.
Okay.
So it's supposed to get there, you know, that's the latest is 10 days. So it's okay. It's in their administrative rules.
Having been on a water board myself
yeah.
and having seen some of the horror stories from medical facilities and other stuff and the kinds of things that can happen with backflows, I think I'm less concerned generally about the agricultural ones because
mm-hmm.
there's not as much pressure coming back the line to feed it back in the system. But in some of these tall buildings where you have stuff, there's a big chance that the pressure on the outside can be greater than the pressure on the inside. And without a backflow device, you have a real problem. So it's pretty ugly what can do with your water system if it gets in the system.
Yeah, Chair, there's a lot of issues even with agricultural because if you think about it, some of the agriculture irrigation, they're pumping chemicals into the irrigated water, and sometimes the pumps go bad and pump the other way overpower the water pressure.
Yeah.
It's not all.
That makes some sense. I hadn't even thought about putting pumps on the other end of the water system.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting configurations, and that's why we do them. That's why we have the assemblies there to protect the public water.
Thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. With that, Brian Craig and Ryan Tribbett.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, in the true nature of a getting stuff measure, we became aware of this at about 1 o'clock today. And unfortunately, our certified smart people are in Boston and in Philadelphia, and I couldn't even pipe them in to you over the network here. So as their lobbyist for the, and once again, Brian Krieg for the record, Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, I will be representing them today. My technical expertise is not as deep as I wish it was in this particular issue, maybe. But I'd like to get to some of the core of the rationale given for this change in that it's rather simple and limited in scope. And however, that's not really true. Backflow is part of a bigger, more complex system. Many of you have touched upon that and the public health issues with it, and then in buildings where you get a lot of pressure issues going on. The public safety element is crucial, and there's reasons for why this was moved back many, many years ago into a situation where it was licensed plumbers being involved in that. And all of our licensed journeyman plumbers and our apprentices do get training in this area. The journeymen do have the ability to do this work. There are some continuing education classes on that that continue. For doing testing work, we would need additional certifications, but I think those are available via the Building Codes Division. And perhaps at some point you might be able to call upon someone from Building Codes Division here to answer maybe some of the technical plumbing licensing issues like that for a little bit more clarification. This really does expand the scope and the oversight of a program that is awkwardly put in health services, and it expands it into areas that really are covered by the Building Codes Division and then the Plumbing Board itself, which is set up to take care of, you know, these types of issues. So we're very concerned about whether even the language really starts to get into a situation that we're going to be competing with code. We haven't had enough time to even begin to look at the ramifications of that. But there's a few other questions that I'd like to put, you know, to just kind of throw out that maybe really haven't been brought up and dealt with on this. And the plumbing code, and does this compete or really work with it, is one of them. But what it would be the role of the plumbing board within this, because you're expanding this into the repair work, and then it's a long-term situation. Is this certification going to be a one-time certification? Is there continuing education required? What's actually required, and who deals with that? Where is that certification going to be housed? Well, it currently as is at the health services, but this is getting into physical repair, and is that something that they really have people there that have the right technical background to be monitoring and approving language for? And how would that be done? Then the next question really would be, how would this expansion and monitoring that certification be paid for? This would be an unfunded mandate there for the health division. Currently, though, you know, programs of this nature, when they're at the plumbing board, this comes out of our plumbing fees and combination of licensing fees and different permit fees. Then what is the training and apprenticeship program for this? Is there any kind of long-term built up, you know, program for that? You have some people that get certified, but really, how do they get that certification? How do they get that training in an organized manner? I'd like to just kind of note also, when we talked about the system and being an overall system, it's kind of like a little bit like your car. Many people are able to take out a spark plug, check certain things of it, maybe clean it up, put it back in the car, and the car runs. But what was the underlying problem that was giving you? Was it the spark plug itself, or was it something in the system? I think Ms. McNitton mentioned about gravel or dirt in the system. Well, these are supposed to be closed systems. Well, if there's gravel or dirt in the system, that could be indicative problem of something else somewhere else in the system. And if the plumber doesn't actually know that, and the person comes in and cleans the system and does it, you may have a lot bigger problem going on, and one that really does affect public health on that. I think in concluding, I'd like to note that this isn't an issue where the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association is looking at this as a big monolithic organization. Over half of our 200 plumbing contractors are small shops of five people or less. We're scattered across the state. We've also gotten language, a letter, I believe, from the Plumbing and Heating and Cooling Contractors, another group that has similar concerns to ours on here, very strong concerns about this. It isn't a union, non-union. It isn't big versus small. It's not labor versus management. This is an issue about training and knowledge and getting into something that's much larger than it should be.
For the record, Ryan Trivett with PacWest here today on behalf of UA290 to voice our strong opposition to it. I'd like to reiterate everything he said. We couldn't agree more. Currently, DHS only regulates the testing of backflow flow devices. Repair statutes all fall under the Building Codes Division. We did only learn about this an hour or two ago. Already, there's something that was mentioned today that including but not limited to accessing the internal code, not limited to. So I think a big question is, well, what is it limited to? Because at some point, repairing might require a permit or inspection. There are a lot of other questions. How and when would those permits be needed and inspected? What would the plan for enforcement be on that? Would there be exemptions involved in that? And how would those go about being created or allowed? And again, like he said, how would the program be funded? So these are things that we'd be happy to work with the department to talk about and see if we can get at what the problem is. But with an hour and a half notice, we have I barely got one phone call in with my client about this. So I'd like to voice our strong opposition to the bill. Thank you.
And we are just going to have the hearing today. We're not going to have a work session. But I would like them to really look at it. If I could go out after a tester is there and they say, you know, it looks like it might have a valve problem, and I can undo that and look at it and clean it out and put it back together, and I'm okay to do it. I'd much rather have someone who has a little bit more testing experience than I had. And currently in the law, I could do that. Because I can change, I mean, I can make an inline repair as a homeowner. So I worry that, I just, a little bit, so we'll get you back here. Any other, you can answer to that if you want, but I'm just, that's one of my concerns about this, is that I'd rather have someone had some experience than me going out there and thinking I can fix it, and I go in and I find out some little thing and I get it out of there and I put it back together and the tester tests it and says, okay, you solved that problem. I really had no idea if I solved anything. All I know is I got it to pass the test. So I'm in worse shape than if it were the tester doing it, who might have an idea of what was going on.
Mr. Chair, you need my son-in-law.
Okay.
He can fix anything.
You don't have to respond to that. It's just a concern that I have if this is a public safety issue.
Chair Roblin, if I may. There's many places in the building codes that we allow homeowners to do work that may not always be the smartest thing in the long run, but there are folks who can figure it out, and in many limited cases, but it's the same thing if you're replacing a light switch. You maybe have a light switch that keeps burning out and giving you a problem and keep replacing. Well, that may really be indicative of something else going on in the system, and that's where bringing in the electrician, they get a little more concerned about it, going to look through the system. Well, the same situation for plumbing here, and it does go back to, while a homeowner and a small one at a home is one thing, but if we start getting into, you know, a little bit larger systems and all too, there's bigger issues at work here. And then, you know, the situation of I do something and I do it wrong, what's the impact on my neighbors, you know, up the line in the water system? We all have a responsibility to everybody else, and while it might have been cheap and we might have been okay with it, that's kind of a big risk in a way.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you were talking, I was thinking back to prior testimony, and without calling up other folks, maybe you guys could help me out with this. You said there are places in the codes now that a homeowner can do their own work on their home. Was there? I thought I heard a reference also to an employee of a business whose business you're doing some of this work to. Specifically a backflow prevention device in this case. Did I hear that correctly or did I not?
Representative Edwards, I don't know the technical background on how the licensing would work in that situation. We'd need to have probably somebody from the plumbing division come to answer that one. There are some opportunities for corporate maintenance staff to do certain things. I don't know whether this falls in with
that. Well, that's what it's a follow-up.
Yeah.
So, the mill that I used to manage, we had a backflow prevention device. It needed to be checked periodically. I can't remember how often. What I'm wondering is, were we, by law, if that backflow prevention device failed the test, by law, could we or could we not have had one of our maintenance guys, one of our millwrights, or staff maintenance go and check, fix that or not? That's my question.
Yeah.
That's my frame of references.
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, I don't know the answer to that. We can ask the folks at the Building Codes Division. I know there's some differences that are allowed for the mills, that there's some different classifications, and whether that's within there or not, as I say, I'd need to ask the Building Codes Division on that.
Okay.
They handle all the licensing. So,
as you know, we're close to the end of the session, hopefully. Would you think people could be available to answer some of those questions more clearly on Wednesday?
Chair, we'll find out.
Chair Roblin,
building trade. I could ask the building codes people.
It would be very difficult for my key client to be able to be back by then, in that he arrived in Boston today for a conference, and I know the representative from 290 who normally handles this issue is at his conference. I don't know whether he would be back by then or not. It would be a bit of a hardship in trying to do that quickly.
We'll ask and find out.
Okay, we'll consider that, and we're on. We've had our hearing, so we can move it at a different time. But I'll keep in touch with you guys because there are parts of this that are very, I think, make sense. But I would like to get some answers to your questions. So. Any further questions? And that's unless there's anybody else here that has been so excited about hearing about backflow that they want to come up and testify now. Okay, we'll excuse you, and I don't see anybody else raising their hand. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2989. I don't see Representative Shields, so I'm going to move to Senate Bill 507A, which we opened earlier for a public hearing. And I'm going to make sure that that's open and also that 508 is open. And we have Brian
Beringer,
Oregon Medical Association. I always say that wrong. And they're both open, so you can answer to both of them instead of having to come back and forth.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm asking if Elise Brown
yes,
might be able to come up as well. The Oregon Medical Association is here today to ask for your support for both Senate Bill 507 and 508. The OMA has been working with the health insurers to build consensus on these bills over in the Senate, and we now bring to you two complete bills with consensus. Senate Bill, I'm not going to echo a lot of what Representative Thompson said earlier, but just to be brief, Senate Bill 507 is another tool that can help us with provider workforce shortages. This bill will allow physicians who are qualified and ready to practice the opportunity to provide health care services to patients and be reimbursed for that service during the period that they are awaiting their credentialing certification from their insurer. Under Senate Bill 507, health plans must make credentialing decisions within 90 days of application. During the credentialing process, physicians will be paid for seeing patients at least at the non-participating contract rate. To ensure high quality of care, the requirement to pay physicians during the credentialing period does not apply to any physician who has previously been denied participation or terminated from a health plan and subjected to peer review. With that, I'll just say we've worked very hard on Senate Bill 507, and we hope that you can pass it out of committee. Thanks.
Representative Roblin, members of the committee, Elise Brown, representing LifeWise Health Plan and America's Health Insurance Plans. America's Health Insurance Plans is a national trade association representing insurers across the country. And our members in Oregon that were involved in the lengthy process involved Pacific Source, Regents, Kaiser, United, HealthNet, ODS, and Providence. So literally everyone was at the table on this. And the conversations began back in February, and I'm proud to say that the final amendments that were submitted jointly. So we are here. We, the carrier community, are here to support both Senate Bill 507 and 508. Thank you.
Any questions for these witnesses? I want to thank you. And I appreciate. I was concerned this was going to be an aquarium, and I couldn't figure out how it fit in. No. Thank you both. I don't think any other questions. Thanks. Again, this one wasn't as thrilling as the backflow devices, but if there's anybody here who did not sign up, that's all who signed up for 507 and 508. I see some people squirming in the back.
No.
So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 507, and we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 508A.
You'll have one open on HJM 23.
And now we're going to go back to HJM 23, which is already open, and we do have a couple people. Roger Williams and Audrey Engel. whichever wants to go first is fine with me.
Okay, my name is Roger Williams. Chair, good to see you today.
Yeah.
I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Christian Home Education Network Association, one of the two statewide home education organizations. And I you might want to follow along because some of the quotes from the UN committee require you to actually read along. You've been receiving emails and calls on HJM 23 from families across the state. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child defines new rights for children which would be enforced against their parents. Good parents here in Oregon. I hope you'll take to heart the concerns you have been hearing about how this UN treaty will interfere with normal parenting and family relationships. But I'm here to talk about another aspect of the treaty. The treaty is officially interpreted by an 18-member UN-appointed committee who are authorized to make recommendations based on their own viewpoints rather than being accountable to anyone else. From Article 43 of the treaty, the members of the committee shall serve in their personal capacity. The committee's recommendations to a country are intended to show where the country is out of compliance with the treaty provisions, and they define the meaning of the treaty. The committee actually defines the meaning of the treaty. They are the official interpreters. An area you would be interested in is the official interpretation of Article 4 of the treaty, which says, with regard to economic, social, and cultural rights, state parties shall undertake such measures to the maximum extent of their available resources. You may interpret to the maximum extent of their available resources to mean within the budgeted resources. But the committee members are focused on their area of concern, children's rights. So they have a different interpretation. They told Indonesia, the committee is concerned at the small proportion of the budget devoted to the social sectors. The committee draws the state parties' attention to the need to respect the provisions of Article 4 of the Convention, which emphasize that economic, social, and cultural rights should be implemented to the maximum extent of available resources. The committee emphasizes that such action is required. And then again to Indonesia later on, the committee reiterates that the implementation of these principles is not to be made dependent on budgetary constraints. So is that, I hope that's ringing with you. And to Ethiopia, the committee said, in addition and in particularly in the context of high military expenditure, the committee is deeply concerned that the state party has not sought to implement the convention to the maximum extent of available resources. And then later on to Ethiopia also, in the light of Article 4 of the convention, the committee urges the state party to prioritize and increase budgetary allocations for children at both national and local levels in order to improve the implementation of the rights of the child throughout the country. Now, just recently, this legislature, and you're still going through it, has gone through the difficult process of trying to match available funds to the various needs in the state of Oregon. We call the result our state budget. Do you really want to invite an appointed UN committee to prioritize the use of resources in the state of Oregon based on their focused mission of creating new rights for children? While we are thinking locally here in Oregon, you might consider the body of statutes and rules we have already developed specifically to address the needs of Oregon children. That's what you guys do every day. Those would be overruled by whatever the UN committee determined was best for children throughout the U.S. That power would move from the state of Oregon to the federal government, whichever way that is, which in turn would be dictated to by the UN committee members. Do you really want to ask the U.S. Senate to do that to Oregon? Please consider the ramifications of HJM 23 for Oregon families and for the state as a whole. And then let the bill die here, please.
we'll ask questions after both.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Audrey Engel, and I'm here with my family to oppose House Joint Memorial 23. Very simply, we do not agree with this memorial, nor do we believe that the United States should adopt the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. First, to adopt the treaty would be to surrender an important part of our sovereignty. Article 6 of the United States Constitution states that along with the Constitution and other federal laws, all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. If we sign the CRC, it becomes federal law, overriding federal law as well as state law. A major argument seems to be that everybody else is doing this, but other countries do not deal with treaties the way that we do. If you examine their human rights records, you will find that many countries sign a treaty like this and then just ignore it. We take our word seriously, though. We would follow the CRC at cost of coming under the vote of the other member nations. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child would determine U.S. policy, not we, the people of the United States. My second point is to emphasize the danger surrounding of surrendering our national sovereignty. The CRC places children under the government's authority rather than parental authority. For example, the state of Oregon must currently prove parental abuse to remove a child from his or her parents. The CRC, however, assumes that the parents are guilty. Under its provisions, a child has the right to take a family dispute to court, any family dispute, eating certain kinds of food, what chores a child is required to do, where the child is allowed to go. I know that I have had discussions with my parents over things like this, but they were family issues and should be dealt with in the family unit. In cases where there is evidence of abuse, we already have state and federal laws to protect the children involved. Absent proof of neglect or abuse, neither the children nor their parents need a family discussion to end up in court. My brother and his wife are expecting their first child this fall. I hope someday to be a mother myself. Please, we don't want to have to raise our children with the fear that international law will dictate how we teach our children, how we raise our children, or that a childish complaint would lead our own child against us in court. I did not have time to research this issue as I would have hoped to. I can't cite the cases where these problems occurred, but they have. I hope you will vote against the House Joint Memorial 23. Please, don't make family issues a matter of international law, and don't let other countries dictate our laws. Thank you. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for these witnesses?
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several times, and thank you both for coming to testify. You referenced new rights several times in your testimony, sir. What new rights are we talking about? You referenced it several times, so what new rights is this committee focused on your children?
Right to freedom of association. Right to privacy within the family. There's probably about 20 articles just on individual types of rights. As she said, the right to appeal to the court system if the child disagrees with something that the parents are doing regarding the child. Freedom to, I don't know if I mentioned this, freedom to seek out and receive any information that they want. Those are some of the rights. And when you first think about those rights, they sound, oh, well, of course. But when you think further about what the role of the proper role of a parent is, as far as rearing a child, then suddenly it gets murky, and you start seeing some dangers in that. Those are some of them.
Thank you.
Pardon me, Representative Roblin.
No problem. You're doing fine. Any other questions of these witnesses? thank you both for coming. And I've seen both of you before. I appreciate the interest you take in our government, which is very important. So thank you. Did that pique anybody's interest in wanting to come up and speak? I see no one else looking forward to it. So that ends all of the people who are signed up for HJM 23. So we'll close our public hearing on HJM 23. We had no one signed up for our other bill, 2932. So we will make a decision on where we're going to put that bill in the future. And with that, unless there's any discussion from our committee about things that they would like, we will close our meeting on rules.